Abdo versus Commonwealth, Mr. Emmett, we should have carpooled.
Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert. On this appeal, I represent a police officer who was convicted of contempt because he was 9 minutes late for traffic court. It's usually my preference in these appeals to begin with the issue that I think is the fulcrum of the appeal, and I'm going to ask you to allow me a little bit of latitude here to start from the first 60 seconds somewhere else, because I think I need to address the elephant in the room. It had to occur to each of you as you were reading these briefs, why is Steve Emmert appealing a $25 fine? And actually, as an officer...
That thought never occurred to me.
Well,
I've known you a long time.
I actually have to let you know that it was suspended, so it's not even a $25 fine. We're talking about court costs here. The reason, as I think we outlined in the discussion of Assignment 3, is that I'm now fighting for a law enforcement career. He's been convicted of a crime, and therefore he's not going to be able to continue as a police officer and will lose security clearance. That's why this issue matters. That relates to Assignment 3 in the way that we said, because I believe that this issue is one that the court can reach under either ends of justice or good cause. Assignment 3 is one that I will charitably say was not preserved as well as I would ideally like to have seen, although there is a place to hang my hat. And yet, it is abundantly clear from this that the trial judge considered inadmissible evidence. This man was convicted because of unadjudicated prior bad acts. And as it says in the, I think, paragraph 8 of the written statement, he convicted him because of those. If not for that.
Courts do that all the time.
They maybe do it all the time, but it's not legal to do it all the time. That's only admissible for limited purposes and as the
what about intent?
Intent is the issue. And as I've indicated in the case of the Boney case, for example, intent is something that can be used as a basis for admission, but it's extremely circumscribed. And the Commonwealth, in its response, merely says, well, it's admissible to prove intent, and stops the analysis. But the mere fact of intent alone is not enough. That was the Cooper case, in which it said intent's an issue in every case. So you can't just say that it relates to intent. It has to be related to the same, has to have
a nexus.
Contempt's
always a kind of a peculiar situation, because it clearly involves the court as a witness, inevitably. It seems to me you and Judge McCullough just put your finger on the point here. The record reflects the court considered the fact that this officer had done this on a number of prior occasions. And while in the abstract, the notion is just because you did something bad on a prior occasion doesn't mean you're guilty of a crime on this occasion. The question really is, the court is aware of that. It has witnessed this officer's conduct on other occasions, and it suggested to this court that on this occasion, this was not an inadvertent situation, it was an intentional situation. And tell me, or tell us, why the court cannot consider its own information that it is aware of about prior similar situations in considering what the subjective intent of the actor is in a situation like this.
Let me explore one aspect of that question before I go to the meat of it, and that is, the trial judge has seen this before and so is entitled to say enough. No one has suggested, either at the trial court or in this court on brief, that Officer Abdo was lying. Nobody's ever suggested that. If it will come today, it will come in the next argument that you'll hear, and I will not have any advance notice of it. Everybody agrees that this is the explanation that was given, and nobody doubted him. The judge simply said, you've done this too many times. Again, what he's doing is amalgamating previous incidents, which may be years ago.
But isn't there a situation where he can assess the officer's credibility without thinking that he's completely lying? Because he'd given this excuse, you know, once before, hadn't he, that, well, my wife took my car, I didn't know she was going to take it, and my summonses were in there, and then that happened again this time, yet he knew if he went and got them, he'd be late, and presumably he could have come on without the summonses, although that would be difficult.
That would be a problematic issue. It wouldn't be a very interesting trial court. In any event, what he did was what a reasonable person should have done. You make a phone call, you say, let him know, please set the case down.
And the judge knew, didn't he? Didn't the other officer tell the judge?
Officer Reese, they stipulated that Officer Reese told the judge, Officer Abdo is going to be a few minutes late, but he'll be here. And then 9 minutes later, he showed up. What the judge did instead of what you and I would normally see in this situation, calling Officer Reese's cases, or at least one of them, to allow that to happen, he effectively accelerated the effect of this by saying, no, we're going to call Officer Abdo's cases right now. That's what happened. And I think we can all understand, we're men, we all understand what happened in the judge's mind. I'm tired of this man not showing up at 9 o'clock on the dot. Well, again, he's convicted him in this instance, not for doing it this time, but for having done it before. That's exactly what it says in the judge's explanation. Now, let me turn to the real meat of this, which is assignments 1 and 2, and the issue of whether the Commonwealth has to prove intent. The Commonwealth at this point.
Let me just throw some, I know you want to get to that. This case is confusing to me on two levels. One is, it's not obvious to me why this is summary contempt, right? Summary contempt is lawyer utters an expletive or witness throws a chair or whatever. The court witnesses it then and there, drops the hammer because the court saw it happen. Here the court issues a show cause and then we have a separate hearing and we have evidence. So I don't understand why it's summary contempt to begin with. And it's not. I mean, it's criminal contempt.
Right.
So that's the first problem. And then the second problem I have is, it's hard to figure out the. I mean, because the court doesn't say which part of summary contempt the court is acting under.
Right.
There's hints that it may be because the court, I think, erroneously considers this person to be an officer of the court, but maybe it's some other provision. So all this leads me to say, why don't we? I mean, what's your response to this? Just send it back to the court for clarification. Because if the lawyers are struggling to figure out what the court did, and it's not clear from the record what the court did, why not get a clarification from the trial court? What exactly are you doing? And then we're in a better position to assess these different arguments.
Up until the last 10 seconds of that, I think I was prepared to answer that. And I don't know the answer to the question of why shouldn't we simply send it back. The case is over. The case has been tried. I know that the general district court judge did, as Your Honor indicated, mistakenly view him as an officer of the court. The circuit court judge did not expressly.
It's clearly not that. We all agree on that.
Okay. The circuit court judge didn't repeat that error. And so we don't have anything in the record to indicate that that was the mistake that was made here. I don't see any basis for a conviction under 456 other than paragraph 1. Because there was no order for him to appear. He's not an ordered officer of the court. We all know that. So the
and if
only
it's
thing
one, how is it within the immediate vicinity? I mean, because the way I read that statute was, it's something the court directly observes, and the statute then sweeps into it behavior, like if someone is out in the hall and disrupts the court proceeding because they're carrying on, so it's so near as to cause a problem. Well, here he's at home, or chasing down his wife, or whatever he's doing. It doesn't even seem to fall within the plain language of one.
I've noted that this case was tried under what may arguably be the wrong section, but that's the way that the case went.
Small the case.
It is, and I'm not going to try to ask you to undo it for that reason. However, under these circumstances, the only difference that the Commonwealth has left to justify this is that the Singleton doesn't apply because the attorneys there had to deal with the prosecutor. Phrased another way, they intentionally did not go to court.
Well, it seems to me in Singleton, the Supreme Court relied heavily on the fact of the custom of the local court and the fact that this had not, that there was no evidence in the record that this was a chronic situation on the part of Singleton. That's clearly not the case here. Here, there's some evidence that I don't know if chronic is the proper term, but at least it had occurred before. And also in Singleton, the Supreme Court noted that the cases were ultimately continued. Here they were null pro, so there was some detriment to the Commonwealth, obviously.
Right.
And so it seems to me there's some clear distinctions between Singleton and other than just lawyers and cops should be able to get away with this stuff and nobody else should. Is that, you know?
Well, two things. One is I don't recall that the discussion in Singleton. I'll review it while Ms. Warren is speaking. That there was a reliance upon the local practice of the court. I'm not sure about that. But
maybe reliance is too strong a word, but I think the court recognized that the local practice was to, you know, with a phone call, you know, tell the prosecutor to continue the case. And you and I both know down in Hampton Roads that's a common practice as well.
Absolutely. And in this case, the court could have just as well accepted the phone call to the other officer who's got a docket saying, Officer Abner will be here in just a few minutes. And that's when he arrived. May I leave to respond in the time remaining?
5 minutes and 30 seconds, that would be fine. Yeah.
May it please the court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth. Your Honor, I would like to first address your question about sending this back, Judge McCullough. And I think the issue here is that when the record isn't clear, any problem in the record falls on the shoulders of the defendant. And here we have a statement of facts. If something needed to be clarified in the record, then the time to do that was in the trial court, not on appeal.
Doesn't sound like either party has an appetite for that, so that's fine. I'm just throwing it out there because I sure was confused about why summary contempt and
what the basis was for
conviction.
I don't think he had a summary contempt proceeding. He was given all of the protections of a non-summary contempt proceeding.
The court seems to have limited itself to the bases for summary contempt when in fact plenary contempt is much broader than summary contempt.
But I don't know that he couldn't be convicted under plenary contempt under this code section. I don't know.
That's right.
I don't think that this code section is only limited
to summary
contempt.
Giving someone more process than there might be due under a particular statute doesn't create a problem.
Yes, and so because this statute doesn't simply say only summary contempt, you can also be convicted of plenary contempt under this statute. And he was given the opportunity. He was given an attorney. He was given the opportunity to present evidence, et cetera, et cetera, and the opportunity to cross-examine, if you will. He had those opportunities, so he had all of the protections of as if it was not summary contempt. Having said that, back to the issue of defects in the record. I mean, I think counsel has suggested that there was no suggestion that this officer was lying. Well, we don't know what the judge felt or considered when he convicted him. He may have, in fact, thought he was lying because he had repeatedly given these, in fact, the same exact excuse on another occasion for being late. And I certainly suggested in my brief that the court could have considered his testimony and not considered it to be truthful. I mean, I think I cited Wright versus West in those other cases, so I guess I'm a bit confused as why that comes as a surprise when we don't know from the record why he convicted him, whether he believed that he was telling the truth or not. And certainly there was a basis, I would argue, that the court could have found that he wasn't telling the truth because he had repeatedly again, come over and over again with excuses as to, and sometimes no excuses, as to why he was late to court. On this particular occasion, I would like to address the issue of the admissibility.
Can I ask on that real quick? How many instances does it indicate where he not only was late, but did not appear at all without explanation? Were there two of that?
My recollection, and I'd have to go back and look in the record, but I believe that there were two occasions when he offered previous explanations, and I believe the judge said several other occasions in which no explanations were offered. I'm not sure that there's a definitive number.
Was he there at all, just there late, or did he not?
Well, I do know that on that I believe on at least one occasion he did not appear at all, and I know that in several of these occasions these issues resulted in his cases having to be null prost. And really that's the issue here when we're talking about intent to obstruct justice. Because he knows that his cases have had to be null prost before when he's not in court on time or does not appear at all. And in fact, he had this very same excuse
but in
before.
In this particular situation, he was only barely late, and he'd ask an officer to call and let the court know, and the officer told the judge he'll be here in a few minutes. He's just had to go get his summonses.
Well, I would like to point out for the record that what we have is a stipulated testimony, meaning that we stipulate that this is what this officer would testify to. That is at odds, frankly, with what the judge said in his certificate of conviction, which is that no explanation was offered. And I think it's up to the circuit court to weigh the evidence. This is a strange situation in that we have conflicting testimonies and nobody's cross-examining anybody in this case because this was the stipulated evidence that he would present. The other is a certificate of conviction in which there's no cross-examination. But nonetheless, it's up to the circuit court to view all the evidence and weigh the evidence and come to a decision. And he gives no explanation other than, you know, a very limited one in the record of why he is convicting this defendant. So that would be my response to your question. I mean, we had this officer testifying that he told the judge this, but the judge says no explanation was offered. And then when his cases were called, he wasn't there, and it resulted in these cases having to be null pros. The most important thing here, I would say, Your Honor, is that this is he knew he had been admonished. He had been given chances and said, it's very important, and he admitted on cross-examination, I knew the importance of being to court on time because I had been previously admonished about this.
That an officer knows that, but how do you respond to Mr. Emmert's point that it appears here, the trial on this day, the trial judge was really trying to get his cases null pros because he wanted to make a point of this?
Well, I mean, I disagree with that. I think that there was evidence that was presented by the defense in the form of a stipulation that stipulated evidence so that the witness didn't have to be called, that this is what happened. And there was evidence presented by the certificate of conviction that he gave no explanation. So I disagree with the characterization. I also disagree that whether he lost his job has any relevance to this case. It doesn't usually isn't something that's considered as something to be considered a miscarriage of justice, whether something should be admissible. And I don't, I mean, other than it's maybe mentioned, I don't, in the brief, I don't think it's in the record. So I would object to that being a basis for miscarriage of justice to get around the failure to preserve the argument exception. And I would simply say that with regard to his failure to object to this evidence coming in, on page 11 of the appendix, it very clearly says that the certificate was received without objection. And it's impossible. Part of the argument that we've had here is, well, we don't know whether this was admitted for intent or knowledge or credibility. Well, of course not, because there was no objection. So the judge didn't give a reason on the record. So therefore, we have to look and see whether it's admissible for any reason. This court shouldn't even consider it because there was no objection on the record. And there was a duty to object if there was something objectionable within this certificate. There was a duty to object at that point.
Do we know that there was no objection?
Pardon me?
Do we know for sure there was no objection?
Because it says on page 11 of the appendix, it was admitted without objection. Okay.
So we don't have to worry about... I mean, the problem with these truncated proceedings where the district court writes up what happened is you don't always know. The court may not capture absolutely everything that happens.
No, I'm talking about the circuit court's statement of facts. Or talking about that it was admitted without objection on page 11 of the record. So the court considered the certificate of conviction from the district court, and it was admitted without objection. And so there was no objection in circuit court. And of course, it is the defendant's duty to make a record if there's a problem with the statement. I mean, this is always the problem with statement of facts cases, is that they're never as good as a transcript. But it is their duty to make sure that the statement of facts accurately reflects what happened in the record. And here we have a very definitive statement that it was admitted without objection. Now, the argument, I think, is that, well, these things come in because there's a statute, and therefore I couldn't have objected. But there's still a duty to object if there's something objectionable within that certificate. That's how laws are changed. You say, well, this may be admissible under current law, but it shouldn't be because of this other reason. I mean, that's how we ended up with confrontation clause law. And we just heard the argument on those sorts of issues. So there's still a duty to object to objectionable material within the certificate if there was hearsay or something along those lines. Or, in fact, prior bad acts. I mean, maybe it would have come in under the hearsay rule because that's the point of the certificate of conviction, so the judge who's incompetent to testify doesn't have to testify. But if there's something objectionable within that certificate, it's still his duty to object to it. If the court doesn't have any further questions from me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. Mr. Emmert.
Let me begin at the last point that she made on the statute. 459 says, in relevant part, such judge, sitting without a jury, shall hear the case upon the certificate and any legal testimony adduced on either side. It says that the judge has to hear the certificate. There's no mechanism provided in the creation of the certificate for objection by the defendant. There's no mechanism for any input into the accuracy of the certificate by the defendant, not even by the prosecution, by the way. The judge does it by himself.
But, I mean, does that matter? Because you may not have a statute necessarily that spells out when and where you can move for reconsideration or clarification or whatever. Why isn't that just a motion you can make in the general district court to say, well, hold the phone, the certificate says X, my recollection is different, it needs to be clarified or amplified or whatever. Why can't a lawyer come in and do that?
It doesn't provide for it in the statute. It says that the certificate...
We're right, but there's all kinds of motions and things that aren't expressly provided in the rules of court or the statutes, but the lawyers can come in and ask for it.
I think the way the statute is crafted is different, Your Honor. It says the certificate shall forthwith be transmitted by the sentencing judge to the clerk of the circuit court. It doesn't provide for any input at all, any objection, any motions. It just says you forthwith provide it to the circuit court, and then it says the circuit court shall try the case upon that certificate, plus any other legal testimony. So that's the way the system is set up. Again, I'm not asking you to completely overhaul Virginia's procedure for this. I am asking you to view this in the sense that this is good cause for not objecting in the first instance. And there certainly is the ends of justice exception, which I've told you about before. There are also a couple of places that I've indicated where I can hang my hat, and I laid those out in the brief. I won't repeat them here. Ms. Bourne indicated that Officer Reese's testimony was stipulated to, but not the truth of what he was saying was stipulated to. I think that's a fair summary of what she said. Effectively, she's asking you to do something that we tell juries all the time not to do. You may not arbitrarily disregard unimpeached, not inherently incredible testimony. That officer was there. He told the judge, Officer Abdel will be here in a few minutes. And then the officer presumably was ready to call a couple of his cases before he was abruptly told, sit down, we're going to call Abdo's now. That's what happened in this case. As far as the loss of the job not being in the record, it's on page 8 of the appendix in paragraph 16. This was expressly raised by the defense lawyer to the trial judge, and on the next page, I think maybe the second page after that, the judge rejected it. So this is a matter that has been submitted to the attention of the court. Fundamentally, we have a police officer who is facing the loss of a career over 9 minutes, something that's happened to every one of us back when we were lawyers, something that we have seen happen to witnesses and police officers all the time. I understand that the judge got irritated, but getting irritated is not the reason to discard the Singleton doctrine. They have to prove, an intent to interfere with justice, not, as I've described it, planning your morning poorly. That's what happened to the lawyer in the Wise case that I pointed out in the reply brief, by the way. He planned his morning incredibly poorly, and when he tried to explain, the Supreme Court did not agree with his explanation, and yet they set the judgment aside anyway because he had done everything he was supposed to do. He called, he asked that it be set down, and he arrived as promptly as he could. That's what this officer should get.
Well, isn't that a little bit different? He was, if I remember in Wise, correct me if I don't have this right, that he was in one proceeding in one jurisdiction, and that didn't finish. So he was late getting into, I think, the city of Richmond for another one.
Your Honor's right. He scheduled one hearing at 10 o'clock in Henrico, or I had it backwards, and then the other one at 11 o'clock in the other court, whether it was Henrico or Richmond. A very difficult situation, considering it was 1897. So the Supreme Court even said he set it up so that he could not keep both of these. They didn't believe him when he said, I think I could have gotten to this. And they still set the conviction aside. That's what should happen. I appreciate your interest in the issues of this appeal and for your courtesy to me today.
All right, thank you, Mr. Arndt. We're going to come down to Greek Council and